From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. April 4th, 2018 marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. King's impact and the nobility of the struggle he led is no longer contentious or in question. Indeed, the civil rights movement in the U.S. is held up as a model for current movements and sometimes used to undermine existing movements for civil, political, social, and human rights. For example, the Black Lives Matter movement has been demonized by some of the same forces that lauded the civil rights movement. Now a new book offers a realistic portrait of the civil rights movement that neither romanticizes nor diminishes its many tactics and struggles. In her book, A More Beautiful and Terrible History, best-selling and award-winning author Jean Theo Harris writes, quote, "The national fable of the civil rights movement became a weapon some used against new movements for justice." Jean Theo Harris is a distinguished professor of political science at Brooklyn College of City University of New York and the author or co-author of 7 books on the history of the Black freedom struggle and on the contemporary politics of race in the U.S. Her New York Times bestselling biography, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, won the 2014 NAACP Image Award and the Letitia Woods Brown Award from the Association of Black Women Historians. She joins me to discuss her new book, A More Beautiful and Terrible History, The Uses and Misuses of Civil Rights History. Welcome to the program, Jean.
Thanks for having me.
So when we talk about the progress that the U.S. has made on racial justice, in mainstream America, we have this desire to feel good about all the progress that we've made. And then you have the activists of Black Lives Matter reminding us, no, we haven't made as much progress as we'd like to think we have. What are some examples of how the presence of activists like the Black Lives Matter folks in many ways reminds us of what the civil rights movement truly was?
Well, I think one of the places that we hear this criticism, right, is about how Black Lives Matter is disruptive, it's extreme, it's not going about it the right way. And these very same criticisms are used during the civil rights movement. I mean, I think one of the things to remember is the civil rights movement at the time is not popular. It's not acceptable. I think we've created this idea almost that sort of King and the civil rights movement was acceptable at the time, and it was people like Malcolm X or the Black Panther Party that was unacceptable. And certainly there was tremendous criticism of Malcolm X, the Black Panther Party, but most Americans during the civil rights movement did not agree with the civil rights movement. In polls across the 1960s, in the early 60s, they don't think that freedom rides, that sit-ins are a way to go about sort of change. They don't think that they're going to help. Most Americans don't approve of the March on Washington. Even if we, you know, I think sometimes we would think, oh, that's just the problem of the South. In 1964, a year before the Voting Rights Act is passed, a majority of New Yorkers say the civil rights movement has gone too far. So I think the first thing, I think when we look at the ways that Black Lives Matter is often compared to the civil rights movement, one of the first things we forget is how the civil rights movement at the time made people uncomfortable. It made most people thought these were not the right tactics at the time, thought it was too disruptive. Thought it was extreme. People like Martin Luther King are criticized across the 1960s as extremists. They're treated by the federal government as extremists. They're surveilled as extremists. So I think that's one area where kind of looking at the civil rights movement helps us see sort of Black Lives Matter and other protests today differently if we actually look at how the civil rights movement was actually treated during its time.
It's interesting because obviously if the civil rights movement was popular, victory would have been quick. There wouldn't have been a struggle if the majority of Americans and politicians approved of the movement, thought that they were doing the right thing. There wouldn't have been the fact that it was a struggle suggests, of course, that it was what activists were calling for was unpopular, what they were agitating for was a difficult thing to do. So how do current fables or myths around the civil rights movement deal with that? Is it that people remember the civil rights movement as these benign sort of lunch counter demonstrations, these sort of silent acts of noble, you know, activism that were dignified, and don't remember the blood, don't remember the dogs, the arrests, the beatings, and even the killings?
Well, I think maybe, yes. And then I would also add that somehow in our mind's eye, when we think about, right, the dignified lunch counter sit-ins, we forget that all sorts of people who would never have hit those people sitting in still didn't approve of them, right? But I think we forget about all of the people who didn't agree with the civil rights movement, who thwarted it at various turns, that were not people who would spit, who would burn crosses, but they still stood in the way of the civil rights movement. So I think that's one of the things we forget about during the civil rights movement. In the book, I have a chapter called The Redneckification of Racism, and the ways that I think we remember who stood in the way of the movement in only one form, right? The sheriff at the door of the school, right, with the tiny school kid, black school children trying to get in. We remember it as Bull Connor. Certainly, these were real people, and these were some of the opponents of the civil rights movement. But people who stood in the way of the civil rights movement did a whole host of things that were not always violent, but there were a variety of tactics, of methods that people used, from asserting their political power, from what we might call now gaslighting, sort of charges of racism, saying over and over, there's not a problem, it's a problem of the students, not of the schools, right? Tactics that we're very familiar with today were also ways in the 1950s and 60s and 70s that people forestalled change then as well.
So the good American people who might not have accepted the term racist to describe themselves still stood in the way of the civil rights struggle.
Yes. Hmm. Yes.
So you open your book with the election of Barack Obama as a very important moment where, you know, we as a country began to feel we were past that, you know, chapter of ours of the civil rights struggle. What role did and Obama himself plays a role in kind of moving forward this idea that the country is better for having had the civil rights struggle and seen its victories, and now we're in a better place. How does that feed into the glorification of the civil rights movement?
In part, I think it does so by treating kind of Obama's win, right, as the kind of capstone of the struggle. So like now we're done, basically, or almost done. And even President Obama himself, in 2007, he's campaigning. He gives a very kind of important speech at Brown Chapel in Selma. And he basically says we're 90% of the way there. He uses the word 90%. So in many ways, the victory is treated as really kind of the end of the struggle. And particularly in Obama's first term, one of the few ways that the Obama administration talks about race, talks about sort of racial injustice, is through kind of memorializing the civil rights movement. And they do so in broader, more substantive ways. But at the same time, it's very much a narrative of progress. It's very much a narrative of the past. So you do not see, whether it's Obama dedicating the King statue, whether it's Obama dedicating the Rosa Parks statue in the Capitol, those moments are not used to say, look, we've had these successes, but we have this more to do, and to actually propose steps forward. That's not what those events become. They become about sort of celebrating American progress, celebrating these heroes, but in ways that treats the movement in the past and really doesn't take seriously what people like Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks would be asking of us today.
What are some of the ways in which groups within the civil rights movement, whether they were SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or the NAACP, really did very sophisticated work to move forward their activism that we can learn from today, that movements today can take real lessons from and take heart that there's, you know, those struggles of the past were not popular and that shouldn't deter our current struggles.
The last chapter of the book is focused on the Montgomery bus boycott, which arguably is one of the most iconic moments of the civil rights movement, is a moment that most Americans know. And yet what we know about it is so narrow and distorted from sort of what it was and what it actually took. And part of why I end the book with the kind of returning to the Montgomery bus boycott is because I think it offers us so much for learning about kind of what it took and therefore kind of how we do it today. So one of the ways that I think we tend to think about the Montgomery bus boycott is this idea that it's all about walking. And certainly people walk, but you do not sustain a more than a year long, you know, boycott of public of transportation just by walking. And part of how they do that is they create this incredibly well-organized sort of like carpool sort of taxi system where they set up 40 pickup stations around town and people can go to those pickup stations and get a ride. They're organizing 10 or 15,000 rides a day. People like Rosa Parks gets fired about 5 weeks into the boycott and will spend most of that year on the road raising money and attention for the boycott at home, because to run this carpool system takes a tremendous amount of energy and it also takes a tremendous amount of resources. So I think one thing we can learn from that is organization. I think a second thing we can learn from the Montgomery bus boycott is that they're doing a number of different things. They're using a number of different strategies. So they're using this disruptive consumer boycott. At the same time, not only is there Rosa Parks' legal case before state court, 3 months into the Montgomery bus boycott, they file a proactive federal lawsuit. And that is the case that will make its way to the Supreme Court. And that is the case that will ultimately lead to the desegregation of Montgomery's buses. If we look at who is on that case, 4 women are on that case, 2 of whom are teenagers. And we're having this conversation on the day of this national student walkout. And I think looking at the Montgomery bus boycott is another moment where we see teenagers really taking sort of the lead, pushing forward. The lawyer for the case in Montgomery had wanted to have a minister on the case, and no ministers were willing to be on the case. They were, you know, they were very worried about the fallout of that. So of the 4 people on the case, they're all 4 women, and 2 of whom are Claudette Colvin, who was the young 15-year-old who 9 months before Rosa Parks is arrested, was also arrested on the bus for refusing to give up her seat. And then an 18-year-old by the name of Mary Louise Smith, who similarly 2 months before Rosa Parks was arrested, had also refused to give up her seat and was arrested. So these 2 teenagers are 4 of these courageous people who are willing to be part of this federal lawsuit that ultimately is part of how we get the desegregation of Montgomery's buses. So they're trying lots of tactics. That's another thing. They're trying lots of different things. They're angry. I think one of the things in the way that we tend to treat the civil rights movement is we forget that it's also about outrage. It's about anger. Their goals shift. When the boycott begins, it's a one-day boycott. They change it to an indefinite boycott. When the boycott begins, they're not even calling for full desegregation on the bus. That will come over time. So I think another thing we can learn is that being in motion kind of changes what you imagine is possible. So I think there's so many, and I think this is one of the things that's been stripped out of the way that the civil rights movement is fabulized, is it doesn't show us how they did it. And I think when we look at how they did it, it offers us much for today.
And yet today, so much of that history has been sort of swept aside. You point out in your book as well that we have this conversation around it at an era when movements are active, but then the counter movements to thwart them are just as active. We have a government led by a man who has unleashed the FBI to target so-called black identity extremists without acknowledging the fact that that was the same logic used against members of the civil rights movement that today would be anathema to describe as black identity extremists. I mean, Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King would have been classified by the FBI as black identity extremists, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. And I mean, I think One thing also to remember in this moment, right, where the opposition also seems so powerful, is how powerful the opposition seemed then. And again, a whole variety of opposition. So the group that forms in New York to oppose school desegregation is a group that calls itself Parents and Taxpayers, right? And it's a group of white parents that are asserting that their rights as parents and taxpayers are the most important, and that therefore they shouldn't be, they and their kids should not be required to sort of change schools or to have their schools changed. And they're very sort of, and again, this is in this 1960s, but in language very familiar to us today, right? They're talking about sort of the problem of students not having certain students, not having the right culture, not having the right behaviors, and they don't want, they're talking about crime, they're talking about how they don't want, these white parents are talking about how they don't want their kids endangered, they don't, you know, what these other kids need is better values, better work habits, that's what's going to make them succeed, not desegregation.
So personal responsibility over systemic rights.
Exactly. Yeah. And we see, again, we see that throughout the civil rights movement as a way to deflect, particularly outside of the South. This is a tactic, you'll see it in Boston. They'll say, we don't have inferior schools, we have inferior students. You'll see it in LA, right? Across the country, one of the strategies, because again, there are movements for school desegregation and school equality across the country. And part of how they're being demonized as reckless, as these people are angry, but they're also being questioned, we don't have a problem here, and the problem is actually the students, not the schools. What we need to do is work on things like juvenile delinquency. You see all sorts of money being thrown in the 1960s towards juvenile delinquency as a way to try to obscure this conversation about school desegregation.
Also, we've seen that after that today we're seeing the criminalization of protest, probably precisely because protest has had such an impact. In the year before the Trump took office, we saw massive mobilizations at Standing Rock in North Dakota. We saw the No DAPL movement really win the sympathy of many Americans, and now states around the country have passed various laws that in various ways make it harder for people to exercise their right to assembly and free speech by criminalizing protest. Did some of that also happen during the civil rights movement? And you know, should that history, the true history of the civil rights movement, inform how we view these very powerful current struggles that use civil disobedience, that use confrontational tactics?
Yeah, so this is absolutely a tactic that happens during the civil rights movement. So again, returning to our example of the Montgomery bus boycott, I think most of us, right, probably the two most famous pictures, or two of the three most famous pictures of Rosa Parks are her mugshot picture that has her holding up the number 7053, and a picture of her being fingerprinted. And those pictures tend to be misattributed, and people tend to caption them with captions about the night that she's arrested for refusing to give up her seat on the bus. And those pictures are not from that night. They are actually from a night about 3.5 months later when Montgomery's been trying to do all sorts of things to break the boycott. One of the things they're doing is the police are giving all these people driving in the carpool tons of tickets. People are getting just tons and tons of tickets. And when that doesn't work, the city dredges up an old anti-boycott law, and they indict 89 people in Montgomery, 89 boycott leaders in Montgomery, to try to break the back of the Montgomery bus boycott. And those pictures that we are so familiar with of Rosa Parks, again, the mugshot and the fingerprinting picture, are from that second arrest. Because, in part, people like Rosa Parks and Edie Nixon, another longtime organizer in Montgomery, don't wait to sort of get arrested. They go and they present themselves. They go in community. That's partly why there is a photographer there to take her picture of her being fingerprinted, is they are trying to use this moment of criminalization, which is meant to shame them and quiet them and again, break the back of the boycott, as a moment to sort of try to not let that happen. But absolutely, that's a tactic that is used across the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, if we look at the Black Panther Party and how many cases get filed and how much the Panthers get mired in legal case after legal case, most of which don't go anywhere, but that sort of the criminalization of activists has a long history.
And of course, the Black Panther Party, it's arguably some, you know, fell apart little by little and was chipped away by those legal challenges. So finally, let's end with a question about Dr. King, because he is, of course, the single most iconic, most famous figure of the civil rights struggle. I mentioned April 4th, 2018 marked the 50th anniversary of his assassination. He is, you know, invoked in almost this sort of holy way now, like one of the sacred gods of American history, even though at the time that he was active, especially near the end of in those last few months of his life when he began broadening his analysis, was really considered somebody who was a troublemaker. How do you think Americans in power, mainstream Americans, those who are not on the left, really need to see Dr. King's true legacy in its fullness?
I think we cherry pick what we want to see about Martin Luther King, and we miss so much of who he was, what his politics encompassed. So the most famous speech is the speech he gives on the March on Washington now, but all we hear is just the last paragraph. King is constantly dreaming. And we don't turn, for instance, to the beginning of that speech. In the beginning of that speech, Dr. King is saying that America has given Black people a bad check and they're there to collect. If we grapple with that King that is saying that Black people are owed something, that Black people have been, when you think about what it means to get a bad check and how you redress that, right? That he's talking about real material redress. I think the second thing we don't grapple with in terms of Dr. King is we tend to Southernize him. King is talking about sort of racism and segregation as not just a Southern problem, but an American problem across the 1960s. He spends a lot of time outside of the South, even in the early 60s, and partly he's raising attention for the Southern struggle, but partly he's joining movements from LA to Boston. And one of the things I think we've airbrushed out is his criticism of Northern racism and his criticism of Northern allies who might be supporting the struggle in the South, but when it comes to local conditions, he says, only the language was polite. The resistance was firm and unequivocal. So basically, King is trying across the 1960s, not just to change the South, right, but to change the Northeast, to change the Midwest, to change the West. And he's finding a tremendous amount of resistance. He's in California in 1964 campaigning against Prop 14, which is a measure on the ballot there because to basically try to repeal in 1963, after a huge fight, a Fair Housing Act is put on the books, and almost immediately citizens and developers get this proposition on the ballot. And so King comes to California multiple times in 64 to try to prevent the passage of Prop 14. He's constantly picketed. He's called a communist. Horrible signs. I think we forget how much King is opposed, not just in the late 60s, but even in the early 60s, and by people who might have supported what he's doing in Birmingham. But the minute he starts to talk about LA, they are not that keen on that.
So
I think grappling with that King, right, and what it means to memorialize that King and not just the King who is dreaming.
And I think so many of us today, after reading your book, would see Black Lives Matter, would see the Standing Rock protesters in a different light when they are placed within the context of a much more nuanced history, such as the one you've written. The struggle really does become more alive. And I think people can get much more wind in their sails when they see the same things that they struggle with today were faced by civil rights activists back in the day. Gene, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for the work you've done in putting this book together.
Thanks for having me.
Gene Theo Harris is a distinguished professor of political science at Brooklyn College of City University of New York and the author or co-author of 7 books on the history of the Black freedom struggles and on the contemporary politics of race in the U.S. We've been discussing her new book, A More Beautiful and Terrible History, The Uses and Misuses of Civil Rights History. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.